This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, now offering Peaberry Especial, a blend of rare pea berries from Colombia, New Guinea, and Tanzania. For a limited time at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
To be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Vancouver libraries will begin to censor the internet.
Clackamas County sheriffs were cleared in the shooting of unarmed motorist Fahd Caddy. We will speak with Northwest Constitutional Rights Center Director about the case.
Oregon looks at mandating health coverage for mental health treatment.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,269 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, February 14th, 2006. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner.
And I'm Doug Guidi. Nearly a century ago, the federal government made a promise to the people of Oregon and 38 other states. If they would help the feds hold vast tracts of land in trust for the American people, the feds would make up some of the tax money that land otherwise could have earned. President Bush's new budget proposal would renege on that commitment. Timber-dependent communities and schools across Oregon will suffer if it passes. The president wants to reduce the county payments program by as much as 60% across 5 years. That is troubling enough news in Marion and Polk counties, as Marion got about $5.6 million and Polk $2.5 million the fiscal year. It's a recipe for disaster in places such as rural Douglas County, where nearly two-thirds of the county's general fund budget comes from this source. All Oregon's schools would also be hit, rural and urban alike. $50 per student doesn't sound like a huge amount, but given Oregon's struggles to pay for education and its large student population, it would definitely add to the school's financial problems. And this comes at a time when Oregon already has the second highest number of elementary students per teacher in the entire country. The White House hopes to win counties over to a scheme by reviving an old idea by tying Oregon's school kids' fortunes to the ups and downs of timber sales, and also sell off some public lands that part. The administration also proposes to sell off some public lands that are the nation's heritage. Among them, 10,000 acres in Oregon, including part of the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area.
Fahd Caddy was shot by a Clackamas County Sheriff's deputy last September. Recently, a grand jury cleared the officer of any wrongdoing. On Saturday, a group of demonstrators held a rally outside the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. Live with us in the KABU News studio to talk about the case and the action is Alejandro Queral of the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center. Alejandro, thanks for coming down.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start out by telling us what happened when Fahd Caddy was shot last September?
Yeah, Fahd Caddy was driving in a road near Sandy, Oregon, and he was involved in a couple of minor accidents, probably the result of a mechanical failure, which resulted in his automobile catching on fire. He apparently was injured in this way and was in tremendous amounts of pain when the police officers, Deputy Officer Willard from the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and another officer found them. And they proceeded to tase him using their equipment, and then eventually shot him, eventually shooting him 7 times and killing him. When this happened, Fahd Caddy was unarmed, was in fact undressed, as he had been trying to get rid of his clothes, which had caught on fire. So clearly, it was an innocent man, possibly in a lot of pain, and the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office responded by using excessive force.
And can you talk about the grand jury verdict? When was it handed down, and what was the gist of their report?
Well, there were two issues here that were of interest to the community. One was a grand jury, which was obviously which heard witnesses that were present at the incident, but which was prosecuted or investigated by the DA's office in Clackamas County. Obviously, this reflects again what is a pattern here, which is police policing their own or the government policing itself. What we're requesting here is greater amounts of accountability. The other aspect of this is that the police conducted an internal investigation, which they call a shooting review board, composed solely of police officers from the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office to review one of their own. Again, we have, in both instances, we have situations where the prosecution or the investigation of this case was conducted basically in-house. Even though there was citizen participation in the grand jury, it is clear that the DA's office has complete control of the grand jury. There's no other attorneys present except the DA, and so the DA can make the case for or against presenting an indictment against the officer.
And the officers were cleared in this case?
They were clear of all wrongdoing.
So can you tell us a little bit about the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center? What do you do?
Well, the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center was originally founded by Alan Graf and a number of other attorneys that were involved in the August 22, 2002 lawsuits against the city of Portland, which eventually ended up settling for nearly $800,000. And the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center is now an advocacy organization which uses litigation to advance its goals. One of the goals that we have, or one of the campaigns that we're working on, is police accountability in Oregon, and particularly in Portland.
The Northwest Constitutional Rights Center website stated that the police have become a secret organization and are in many ways no longer accountable to the public that they are directed to serve. Do you feel that the Sheriff's Office and the Shooting Review Board have acted secretly in this case?
Well, they have acted secretly in as much as they have not made a lot of the information public. They have kept a lot of the part of the investigations under wraps. In other words, it hasn't been a full disclosure. There hasn't been enough transparency for the public to ascertain what actually happened and make decisions on their own so that we can hold the police accountable for their actions.
It's unusual for us to see police accountability issues in suburban communities like Clackamas County. How common is this, do you think?
Well, it's unfortunately, it appears to be very common, and I would think that is because there are not a lot of mechanisms out there which help hold the police accountable by having independent citizen-based review boards or review committees. And so as long as that is not in place, you're going to, you know, there's going to be a greater likelihood of having this kind of incident happen. So I think it's actually fairly common.
All right. Thank you very much. That was Alejandro Caral of the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center. Find out more about them at www.nwcrc.org.
The Salem Police Department plans a public information session as a part of a department-wide assessment of police policies, procedures, management, operations, and support service. Community participation and comments are encouraged at the session, set for 2 p.m. March 6th at the Salem Public Library, 585 Liberty Street Southeast. The assessment will be done by the Commissions on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies. The Salem Police Department must comply with more than 450 standards to gain accredited status.
Oregon joins the growing roster of states with laws mandating that insurance companies must provide the same coverage for mental health treatment that they provide for general health conditions. KBOO's Ross Egan reports.
The new Oregon law is much broader than the federal law in that it requires insurers to provide the same level of care and reimbursement of expenses as other medical conditions. Moreover, the new law requires that all businesses offering group plans comply. That is, it does not exempt businesses with 50 employees or fewer, according to John McCulley, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Psychiatric Association. Oregon is the 36th state to require parity, which could affect an estimated 1.3 million Oregonians enrolled in group health insurance plans. Coverage will not change for state employees or low-income families enrolled in the state's Medicaid program, which already provide parity for mental health benefits. The new law will also not provide coverage to the more than 600,000 Oregonians who lack health insurance. It is estimated that at least 5% of the U.S. population suffers from some form of mental illness. Among the covered conditions included in the new law are schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depressive disorders, obsessive compulsive disorders, and autistic disorders. The law's 2007 implementation date is intended to give health insurers time to prepare to meet the new coverage requirements. Other states that have enacted parity laws have found that insurance premiums have increased by no more than 2%, according to advocates of the Oregon measure. For KBOO News, I'm Ross Egan.
Labor activists who accuse the two major political parties of ignoring pocketbook issues say they are forming a new party. The Working Families Party will aim to better represent segments of the society labor activists say are poorly served. It is modeled after a party in New York of the same name, formed in 1998. Organizers hope it will help reshape the political debate to be geared towards everyday concerns such as wages and health care. Other party goals include improving public schools, making higher education available to the working class, and defending jobs against outsourcing. Organizers are beginning to gather the 19,000 signatures needed to get on the statewide ballot and qualify it as a minor party in Oregon.
The National Association of Secondary School Principals has named Sandy High School Principal Jim Saxton as Oregon's High School Principal of the Year. Saxton taught English at the school for 21 years before becoming vice principal and took the job in 2002. He's faced unusual challenges recently, including helping students, staff, and parents refocus after a 16-day teacher's strike last fall.
Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News and Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. hear Out Loud, discussing the Queer Youth Conference. And at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Clemmie's Grooves. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with scattered showers in the evening, then partly cloudy after midnight. Snow level 500 feet. Lows 25 to 30 with a light wind. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs 40 to 45 with a light wind. You are listening to KBOO Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The Fort Vancouver Library Board voted yesterday to install internet filters. KBOO's Spencer Raymond has this report.
Internet access at Vancouver area libraries will be filtered for porn, the Fort Vancouver Library Board voted Monday. In a 4-3 vote, the board decided to filter all internet access to all users and makes viewing pornography a violation of library policy. Library staff will also monitor internet use when the policy is implemented. Bruce Zygman of the Vancouver Regional Library District said it will take some time for the policy to be implemented.
We have to take the software that's on the filtered machines and install it on all the machines. And, of course, there's some staff training on the new policy, you know, how exactly we're going to manage it from a personnel point of view that will have to take place.
Board member Jack Berkman supported the filter plan after hearing from people who felt uncomfortable in the library. Berkman said it is critical for the library to be friendly to families. Alternative plans, instead of a filter, were to move computer monitors to high-traffic areas where screens would be easily visible to passersby in hopes that the loss of privacy might deter users from inappropriate internet use.
So at the moment, they're all recessed below the desktop level. And this has pros and cons like everything else. It's ergonomically not very comfortable, but it does protect patron privacy.
Free speech advocates spoke out against the plan, and Zygman questions the library's motives.
Should the public library be required to present to the public sites that are designed specifically to be sexually arousing? I mean, is that an appropriate service for the public library to provide? I'm sure there will be some people who will be upset enough to say, I'm not going to use it anymore. I don't expect that to be very many.
Jerry King, the library board chairman and former Vancouver city attorney, said garden variety pornography isn't as obscene because it is widely available. King said that lots of stores in Vancouver sell porn and sells it well. Therefore, porn can be judged as consistent with community standards. According to King, there have been no reports of inappropriate actions around computers. King said there is a concern that something might happen, though. The decision made by the board looks final, with no change in the near future.
I suspect the board will not want to readdress this very soon. The former policy, or the one that's still in place today, has been in place for just a little less than 2 years.
According to a study conducted by the Information Use Management and Policy Institute at Florida State University, 40% of public libraries had internet filters in 2004. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
A new program opens tomorrow in Clark and Cowlitz counties to help nearly 300 people suffering from mental health problems. What makes this effort different than the new services, pairs physical and mental health services. Officials say the new program could serve about half those receiving mental health services in both counties. The two-year program will be managed by Columbia River Mental Health Services and is made possible by a nearly $600,000 grant from the Washington Department of Social and Health Services. For more information, call Columbia River Mental Health Services at 360-993-3000.
The Vancouver Columbian newspaper reports today that a prominent casino opponent got a court order Monday prohibiting the project leader from contacting her. The issue centers on the Washington State Cowlitz Tribe's bitterly contested proposal to build a $510 million casino complex west of La Center. Cammie Beal, founder of the first group to oppose the Cowlitz Tribe's casino plan, received a temporary restraining order yesterday forbidding casino proponent David Barnett from contacting her or coming within 1,000 feet of her. Barnett, of Seattle, is a Cowlitz Tribe member and a developer. He heads the cooperative organization between the Cowlitz and the Mohegan Tribe of Connecticut to develop the 134,150-square-foot casino. Officials say the restraining order was issued solely on the basis of statements from Beal.
The Washington House passed the new Columbia River Management Plan tonight, but the measure depends on the fate of a $200 million funding package recommended by Governor Chris Gregoire. The plan focuses on building new reservoirs and conservation. It passed on a 94-4 vote and now heads to the Senate. The plan seeks to make more water available by increasing two-thirds of the water that would go to users, such as farmers and cities, and one-third would go back to the river to help fish stocks. Volunteer regional agreements would rely on new conservation projects to offset new water withdrawals elsewhere. Gregoire said earlier today that the plan could be, in her words, quote, the most significant breakthrough in 3 decades.
The lawyer shot by U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney in a hunting accident has suffered a minor heart attack, according to the BBC. Harry Whittington, 78, suffered a heartbeat irregularity caused by a pellet lodged in his heart. Mr. Whittington was moved back into intensive care today and will be treated for at least another week. Dick Cheney accidentally injured his hunting companion while shooting quail on a ranch in Texas on Saturday.
It has been brought to the Vice President's attention by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department this afternoon that although he had acquired a $125 Texas non-resident season hunting license, he lacked a $7 stamp for hunting upland game birds. To address that, a member of the Vice President's staff wrote a check for $140, understanding that this would purchase a Texas non-resident season hunting license that would permit the Vice President to hunt quail in Texas. But he did not have the required upland game stamp, which would have cost $7. In the meantime, the vice president has sent a $7 check to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department.
And for something a little different, we go to musical commentary from Tom Lehrer.
I always will remember, 'twas a year ago November, I went out to hunt some deer on a morning bright and clear. I went and shot the maximum the game laws would allow. 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a cow. I was in no mood to trifle. I took down my trusty rifle and went out to stalk my prey. What a haul I made that day. I tied them to my fender and I drove them home somehow. 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a cow. The law was very firm. It's
endured. It turned out there was a reason. Cows were out of season, and one of the hunters wasn't insured. People ask me how I do it, and I say there's nothing to it. You just stand there looking cute, and when something moves, you shoot. And there's 10 stuffed heads in my trophy room right now. 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a purebred Guernsey cow.
A company in the United Arab Emirates is poised to take over significant operations at 6 American ports as part of a corporate sale. The Bush administration considers the UAE an important ally in the fight against terrorism, since the suicide hijackings, and is not objecting to Dubai's Ports World's purchase of Peninsular and Oriental Steam Navigation Company of London. The $6.8 billion sale is expected to be approved Monday. The British company is the 4th largest ports company in the world, and its sale would affect commercial U.S. port operations in New York, New Jersey, Baltimore, New Orleans, Miami, and Philadelphia.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 14th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Jim Thompson. Tonight's audio editors are Kate Welch and Margot Considine. Special thanks to reporters Ross Egan and Spencer Raymond. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Doug Weedy.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, hear Barbara Bernstein host Locus Focus Talk Radio. She'll talk about the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela and more on the World Social Forum in Caracas, with guests Patrick Anstrom-Poor, phoning from Caracas, and Portland activists Elizabeth Attlee and Ellen McKeever. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller features part 3 of It Is Happening Here, a year-long series investigating fascism in the U.S. government and society. He and his guests will explore whether or not the U.S. shows disdain for the importance of human rights. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, February 14, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Low-income residents are being left out in the cold after promises to provide energy assistance go unfulfilled. Violence continues in Iraq. We'll hear about the course of the country's internal politics. And city officials in one Northern California town authorize an independent investigation into police surveillance. All that and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. About 50,000 labor unionists demonstrated outside the European Parliament in Strasbourg, France today. This as the Parliament debated a revised version of the controversial Bolkestein Directive on creating a free market in services throughout the European Union. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
The Bolkestein directive caused widespread protests last year, especially in France, where it boosted the no vote in the referendum on a European constitution. But Conservative and Socialist Euro MPs have drawn up a compromise version, which is due to be voted on Thursday. The new draft states that workers will be subject to the wages and conditions of the country where they're working, rather than their country of origin as before. And it allows countries to refuse access on the grounds of security or protection of the environment, health or consumers, as well as excluding some key sectors such as mail and social services. The hard left, the Greens and the French Socialists still say they'll vote against. Even the unions are split. Some back the changes, while others say that there are still several grey areas over how controls will be enforced and the status of public services. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
The world's largest and most profitable retailer, Walmart, is feeling pressure from state legislatures, asking the company to pay a larger share of its payroll on employee health care. Martha Baskin reports from Seattle.
Similar to legislation that recently passed in Maryland and is pending in 31 other states, Washington State's Fair Share Health Care Act would require employers with more than 5,000 employees to spend at least 9% of their payroll on health care benefits. Walmart defends its benefits package by pointing out that whenever it opens a new store, it gets far more applicants than there are openings. But Walmart critics, like David Groves with the Washington State Labor Council, say the company is subsidized by taxpayers because thousands of its workers opt for government-subsidized health care instead of a company plan.
One of the ways that they are able to beat other employers on price is that they do pay less and provide less benefits. And what they've learned is that they don't need to provide health care because the government will.
Proponents of the legislation remain unsure as to whether the state legislature's Democratic leadership will bring the vote to the floor of the House by Tuesday. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
The outgoing Palestinian Legislative Council has granted broad new executive powers to the president. Manar Jabrin reports.
Late Monday afternoon, the outgoing Palestinian parliament empowered Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to appoint a new constitutional court that would have far-reaching powers, including the capacity to cancel future legislation. Hamas criticized the move, saying that it is an attempt to undermine Hamas's right to rule the parliament. Anwar Zboun, a newly elected PLC member of Hamas, described the move as illegal.
This constitutional court is illegal. Therefore, we will work to change these bills passed yesterday. We consider this as an attempt to strike the Palestinian democracy that brought us to this parliament.
The new parliament, which will have 76 Hamas members out of 132, will be sworn in on Saturday amongst increasing pressure by the United States and the donor countries to stop aid to a Hamas-formed government. This is Manar Jibrin reporting from Palestine.
A court in Argentina has issued arrest warrants for a former dictator and 12 ex-military officers for their suspected role in Operation Condor. Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
A federal appeals court upheld the indictment of a group of military leaders for their alleged participation in a joint scheme to illegally kidnap and kill political activists during the 1970s. Former Argentine dictator Jorge Videla and former Interior Minister Albano Argandegui are among the suspects indicted. Most of the ex-military leaders are under house arrest in connection with other human rights abuse charges. However, because of the gravity of the charges, the court issued warrants for their arrest. If convicted, they could each face a minimum of 8 years in jail. In Argentina alone, 30,000 people were victims of Operation Condor, a shared plan by regional dictators in Uruguay, Chile, Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina to kill opponents in the 1970s and 80s. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona from Buenos Aires.
China has announced the country's first anti-discrimination laws against AIDS and HIV patients. Dante Tosa has more.
The new rules to protect the rights of AIDS and HIV-positive patients will take effect on March 1st. Local governments will be responsible for providing free medication to poor patients and free consultations to infected pregnant women. Also, hospitals will not be able to turn AIDS and HIV-positive patients away. However, AIDS activists in China are unsure of the effectiveness of these new regulations, saying that, for example, there are no legal consequences for a hospital that refuses service to an AIDS patient. Last month, The central Chinese government published a report stating that there are currently 650,000 people in China living with HIV, and the numbers are rising by about 200 new infections per day. From Hong Kong, this is Dante Toza with FSRN.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Home energy assistance programs are causing low-income residents to be left out in the cold, as Congress and President Bush have left promises of providing energy assistance to the poor unfulfilled. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
The two major energy assistance programs are weatherization and LIHEAP, or Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program.
These families often must make hard choices between heating and cooling their homes and other necessities like food, clothing, and medicine. On average, these families will spend more than 15% of their income on energy, compared to 5% for most homes in the country.
Bob Adams is Director of Weatherization Services at the National Association of States and Community Services Program. Most LIHEAP recipients are low income and many are on fixed incomes. The program helps eligible households pay their energy costs at a time when heating prices have risen. But the program is running out of money and a proposal to provide additional funding is tied up in Congress.
We're trying to work it out, and I've been talking to, you know, some of the individual senators. I just made a pitch in the policy luncheon on behalf of the program because it really is about what to do what's right.
The bill would take a $1 billion advancement from the fiscal year 2007 budget proposal. Republican Senator Olympia Snowe from Maine is one of the leaders of this emergency funding.
It's already paid for, and this is not an increase in the program, essentially. It's to hold harmless, you know, where we were last year, given the current increases in energy prices, both home heating oil and natural gas.
Despite a pledge from Republican leaders in the Senate, some Republicans are holding up the funding for various reasons. Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama has said the cost is too high. And some Republican senators in southern states oppose the way the money is being allocated, saying their state won't get a fair share. The need for funding is urgent. The federal money, which is distributed to the states, has run out in 12 states, and five more are extremely close to zero, which would deny new applicants of assistance. And three more months of winter remains in some regions. But advocates are calling for the immediate passage of the bill, plus some.
To appropriate LIHEAP funding of at least $5.1 billion for fiscal year 2006, as well as an advance appropriation of at least $5.1 billion for fiscal year 2007.
Congress said they would fund $5 billion, but the actual amount passed, a little less than $2
billion. In 2005, the number of households that applied for LIHEAP assistance increased by material margin by approximately 9%, while applications from the elderly skyrocketed a whopping 34%.
Ron Jones is talking about his state of Tennessee. He is the chairman of that state's regulatory authority, which oversees LIHEAP. Nationally, only 15% of the homes that need energy assistance are receiving it. The executive branch hasn't fulfilled any hope of fully funding the program. The president proposed $2.6 billion, and if Congress takes $1 billion for their emergency advancement, that will leave $1.6 billion for 2007, with no sight of lowering energy prices. As for weatherization, the other heating assistance program, the president's fiscal year 2007 budget will cut it by 33%. Again, Bob Adams.
It's important to note that after weatherization services are provided, the average family saves about $400 per year based on the current energy prices. The savings potential for these energy services, like insulation, furnace replacement, air infiltration reduction, and others, lasts more than 15 years in most cases.
Advocates want Congress to fully fund $600 million for the program, much more than the $160 million the president proposed. The Senate could try to retrieve some of that money through the appropriations process or with tax incentives, but no emergency funding is in place. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As the Royal Nepalese Army throttles mass protests within Nepal, thousands of Nepalese gathered in the Indian capital, Delhi, to celebrate 10 years of people's war in Nepal. The Janadakir Surakashi Samiti, a union of Nepali workers in India, organized a mass rally vowing to fight until the end for restoration of democracy in Nepal. FSRN's Vinod K. Jose reports from Delhi.
Revolutionary cultural troops of the Maoists of Nepal and India entertained the crowd. A mobilization of over 60,000 Nepali expatriate workers in India assembled to celebrate 10 years of people's war in Nepal. Not long ago, the Nepali Workers' Unity in India, called the Nepali Ekta Manch, was banned under India's terrorism law for supporting the Maoist movement in Nepal. Many of their leaders were arrested, tortured and extradited back to Nepal. Now, after 4 years, the Nepali workforce reunited with the name Nepali Janadhikar Samiti and extended their support to the Maoist movement. Lekna Neopai is the Central Committee President of Nepali Workers Student Union. He came to Delhi to address the Nepali workers.
This is a historic moment. 10 years of protracted people's war by the Maoists is going to establish a democratic rule in Nepal very shortly. The king and the monarchy cannot last long. So this mobilization of thousands of Nepalese is both a celebration of people's war and a statement to the world outside that Nepali Maoist movement is a genuine people's movement, contrary to what the Western, Indian and Nepali administrations propagated all these years.
Jaipuri Gharti is the president of the Revolutionary Women's Association of Nepal.
Feudalism, patriarchy, King Yanendra, US imperialism, Indian expansionism in South Asian subcontinent, all these are our enemies. And the Maoist movement is successfully resisting these enemies because of the support of millions of common people.
The Maoist guerrilla movement of Nepal gathered supports of both the mainstream Indian communists and the underground Indian Maoists. Sidharam Ichuri is the Politburo member of Communist Party of India, Marxist.
The future of Nepal will be decided by the people of Nepal and nobody else. Not Indian government nor Western military aid. We extend complete support to your fight for democracy.
10 million Nepalese live in India. Poverty and unemployment force Nepalese to look upon India, where they often end up in the most exploitative work conditions, from domestic help to construction work to sex industry. From New Delhi, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
One coalition soldier was killed and 6 were wounded in separate attacks in Baghdad today. Meanwhile, the provincial police chief in the southern province of Basra said all security cooperation and joint patrols with British officers had been called off after revelations of prisoner abuse by British soldiers in Amara, the capital of Misan Governorate, north of Basra. As the country's new majority Shiite government increasingly asserts itself against the foreign military presence, the selection of Ibrahim Jaafari to remain in the post of prime minister leaves some concerned about the course of the country's internal politics. Salam Talib files this report, produced by David Enders.
Jaafari's selection split the alliance of Shiite parties that won the majority of seats in the parliament in January's election along party lines. It does little to assuage fears of the Sunni community, which blames Jaafari's government for being unable or unwilling to rein in the Ministry of Interior's security forces. MOI commandos have carried out raids and extrajudicial killings in Sunni neighborhoods in retaliation for attacks on Shiites and on the government. Sunday's vote came down to Jaafari and Adil Abdul Mehdi, who is second in command for the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the party whose paramilitaries are blamed for many of the killings. Though the group's security forces in southern Iraq have clashed with other local militias, particularly followers of Muqtada al-Sadr, they are considered to be more or less in charge of many local police forces, and especially in the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. As was the case last year, the decision on a prime minister was delayed until after the celebration of Ashura, the holiest holiday on the Shiite religious calendar. Under Saddam Hussein's government, the more than 1,300-year-old tradition of making a pilgrimage to Karbala was forbidden. But where many Shiites see a newfound freedom, others see a new oppressor. Ahmed al-Shamrai is a Sunni living in Baghdad.
The elections were along sectarian lines, and Sunni do not like al-Jafari, but there are many issues with Abdul Mahdi. He is the second man after Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, and he had connections to the Ba'ath Party in Saddam's time.
The alliance, which won 128 seats in the 275-member parliament, was left by other parties to select a prime minister. It also marked the first time Sadr's followers, who have the most seats within the Shiite bloc, used their electoral weight to swing a decision. Hamid Majid Musa is the leader of the Iraqi Communist Party and ran with former U.S.-appointed Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, whose parliamentary bloc won 25 seats. The Sadrists have demanded that Jafari prevent Alawi from participating in any new government because of his ties to the CIA. Musa pointed out that under Jafari's government, the war had intensified while many aspects of daily life had deteriorated, especially in Baghdad.
We have criticized al-Jafari's government for its performance, especially in terms of security and the economy and problems with services. If the United Iraqi Alliance has chosen him, they have to study this decision again and check his performance. Otherwise, the problems Iraq suffers from will not get better.
Jafari, whose term would last 4 years, oversaw a rise in oil prices shortly before the elections, something many Iraqis thought meant that Jafari would not be returning to office. The next step in forming the government will be the apportioning of ministries, and with Jafari as prime minister, it is quite likely members of Skiri will argue they should remain in control of the Ministry of Interior. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib for FSRN.
The Bush administration is widening the scope of domestic spying with the help of telecommunications giant AT&T and another secret database that targets peace activists. While the Bush administration justifies its domestic spying programs, grassroots civil rights groups are taking a stand against programs they say infringe on people's constitutional rights. FSRN's Christina Anastad reports.
The Pentagon's Threat and Local Observation Notice, or TALON, database is a listing of potential terrorist threats that includes environmental and anti-war groups. In a national effort to uncover the breadth of the TALON database, the American Civil Liberties Union has made several information requests on behalf of Greenpeace, Veterans for Peace, and dozens of social justice groups across the U.S. that are listed in the database. Lee Johnson is a geography PhD student at the University of California, Berkeley, and a member of Berkeley Stop the War Coalition, a student peace group listed on the TALON database as a threat for its anti-military recruitment protests.
We are outraged, and we should be outraged, but we shouldn't be surprised, I don't think. I think it's fairly clear that we don't pose any sort of domestic threat to this government other than the threat that the people of America, the majority of them are opposed to this war, they're opposed to George Bush, and that is a threat to this administration.
In 2003, neocon and then Deputy Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld created the TALON database to monitor potential terrorist and pre-terrorist activities. Since then, numerous peace protests and progressive meetings have been placed on the TALON database as a threat. In an email, Pentagon spokesman Gregory Hicks wrote threats are reportable events that include nonspecific threats to Department of Defense interests, like tests of security, unusual repetitive activity, and any other suspicious activity. Hicks adds that law enforcement and concerned citizens report information that goes into the TALON database, but according to Rebecca Jeske, a spokesperson for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the government also relies on major corporations to collect people's data. She claims telecoms like AT&T are giving the Bush administration unfettered access to illegally wiretap and collect their customers' calling records.
The government would have a hard time gathering the data that it does without collaborating with the telecoms. And we believe that AT&T gave the government, gave the NSA, the National Security Agency, wholesale access to its databases of historical call data. If they have an eye on a specific person, they can get a warrant. We're talking about wholesale data mining and spying on ordinary Americans. They're taking a really big bite. They are not doing something targeted. We suspect that other telecoms are doing something similar.
The Electronic Civil Rights Group has filed suit against AT&T for infringing on the privacy rights of an estimated 26 million AT&T customers by breaking the Federal Telecom Act and the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. The lawsuit could cost AT&T billions. While the Bush administration widens the scope of domestic spying on peace groups and average citizens, Al-Qaeda terrorist Osama bin Laden has announced his fighters are preparing new attacks on U.S. soil. ACLU of Northern California's executive director Dorothy Ehrlich says spying on average citizens and social justice groups is a misguided waste of resources.
We're not any safer by the government engaging in this kind of surveillance. There have been reports that show that the kind of fishing expeditions that they're engaged in, the fact that they are collecting information that is of very little value when we're looking for real terrorists. We're not looking for students who are engaged in dissent against the war, and that when they use their resources in this manner, they actually make us less safe, and that's a very real concern that we have.
AT&T has 30 days to respond to the class action lawsuit, and the ACLU expects a response from the Pentagon later this month. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I am Christina Onnested.
Police in Santa Cruz, California, released a 6,000-page report Friday detailing its internal probe of surveillance conducted on do-it-yourself New Year's parade meetings. City officials who initially praised the report as thorough and complete are now backpedaling and have authorized an independent investigation. FSRN's Vinny Lombardo has more.
Grant Wilson of Santa Cruz Art and Revolution says the police investigation was a complete waste of time and resources.
It's amazing what the police can come up with in terms of material, but really in terms of substance and action, there's really nothing there.
The internal investigation was led by Deputy Chief Kevin Vogel, the same man who authorized undercover agents to infiltrate parade planning meetings. The officers involved were cleared of any wrongdoing. Vogel's report says police did nothing wrong because it claimed the New Year's parade jeopardized public safety. But Bob Aronson, the independent police auditor under contract with the city of Santa Cruz, rejected Vogel's report as incomplete and flawed, saying there was a conflict of interest.
It was inappropriate for Deputy Chief Vogel to conduct the investigation into his own decision to use undercover officers.
Aronson was tapped by City Manager Dick Wilson to conduct a supplemental investigation that will determine how and why police decided to use undercover officers to get the information they wanted.
My issue is that at first glance, without any other effort, a decision was made to try to put undercover officers into the organizing meetings.
The undercover officers used fake names and contact info, helped with parade logistics, and consumed alcohol at planning meetings. The internal audit reveals a pattern of abuses by police, says Rico Thunder, a parade planner who was a major focus of police surveillance.
The Santa Cruz PD used their presence at the planning meetings to gather information about community groups and First Amendment activities taking place. They used this information to monitor events and tip off other outside agencies.
This is the war on dissidents and the war on the Constitution come home to Santa Cruz.
Local peace activist Sherry Connable marched in the New Year's parade, but had no involvement with its planning.
It is not up to the police chief to fix this. It is not up to the city manager to fix this. It's up to us to fix it, and the only way we can fix it is if our elected representatives speak on our behalf.
Activists want a stringent policy that safeguards the First Amendment rights of citizens engaged in political work. The city's Public Safety Committee, tasked with overseeing police policies, agreed to wait another month for Aronson's report before making policy recommendations. In Santa Cruz, California, I'm Vinny Lombardo for Free Speech Radio News.
According to Amnesty International, the Canadian government, and the Native Women's Association of Canada, Native women are targets of high levels of violence in Canadian society. That violence is being dramatically highlighted now by the opening of the trial for suspected serial killer Robert Willie Picton in Vancouver, British Columbia. Picton is accused of murdering almost 30 women over the past 20 years, many of whom were Native. Today, Native women in Vancouver and across Canada held memorial events for missing and murdered women and to call for more action from the government and society as a whole. Kristen Schwartz has more.
When Janet Henry disappeared from the impoverished downtown east side of Vancouver, her sister Sandra Gagnon took to the streets to find her. She showed Janet's photo to people in the neighborhood bars, to truckers, to random strangers. Janet was one of more than 60 women who disappeared from the downtown east side in the 1980s and 90s. One man, Robert Willie Picton, is now facing trial for the deaths of 26 of these women after their DNA was uncovered on his pig farm in nearby Port Coquitlam. Like many family members and community advocates, Sandra doesn't feel that the disappearances got enough attention.
I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't think the Vancouver City Police really took it seriously when the women started to go missing, because they were from downtown and because of the lifestyles and stuff. But I didn't think it was right, because the women were human beings. The women were mothers. They were women who were loved. They were somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, somebody's friend.
Marlene Trick is a social service worker in Vancouver's downtown east side and an organizer for the annual February 14th Memorial March for the Missing and Murdered Women, held every year since 1991. 500 people were expected to attend today's memorial.
We invite the family members of the murdered and missing women to come and speak. The march is led by elders, and behind them is the drummers and then everyone else. The theme of our march for the last few years has been "Their Spirits Live Within Us."
Grassroots organizing among Native women and the gruesome trial of Robert Picton have brought more attention to the high levels of violence against Native women across Canada. In 2004, Amnesty International released a detailed report calling for changes in policy and laws which affect Native women. Last year, the Native Women's Association of Canada won significant funding for research and education on the issue. The association estimates that more than 500 Native women have gone missing or been murdered in the last 20 years. This year, for the first time, Native women in Toronto and other cities staged events to coincide with Vancouver's Memorial March. In Toronto, a rally at police headquarters opened and closed with songs by the Anishinaabe Kwe singers. Robin Bourgeois was an organizer for the event.
What's clear is that in this country, the whereabouts of a vast number of Aboriginal women is officially unknown. And something like an epidemic is raging across this country and taking lives with impunity.
From CKLN in Toronto, this is Kristen Schwartz for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado in Los Angeles.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 14th of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In Wisconsin, the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa has applied to the Environmental Protection Agency for authority to run its own water quality program on the reservation. Under the Clean Water Act, the tribe would have the same status as a state to determine water quality standards. Nick Vanderpie of the Superior Broadcast Network reports on what this would mean for the band.
More than half of the surface of the Lac du Flambeau Chippewa Reservation in northern Wisconsin is covered by water. Larry Waranowitz is the Lac du Flambeau Tribe's Deputy Administrator for Natural Resources. He says currently there are no legal standards in place for protecting water on the Lac du Flambeau Reservation.
So the reservation and the tribe is intimately connected to the water. I mean, everything that the tribe does, from fishing to providing water for Manoman, for ceremonial purposes, for spear fishing, for supporting a sport fish industry, supporting a tourism industry, is all tied to water.
Water, or in the Ojibwe Indian language, Nabe, is the lifeblood of the community. Manoman is wild rice, a sacred food that requires clean, flowing water. Some industrial advocates and developers are concerned about what they claim to be imprecise, nebulous, or non-quantifiable tribal water quality standards. A Lac des Flambeaux elder, Mike Chosa, says those concerned should remember how Lac des Flambeaux protects the water, especially from today's building boom.
Your lands and your waters where you build your homes so close to the lake and your boathouses, you know, and your big skiing and whatever else, polluting that water, and it's coming this way. It's polluting our lands and our water as well. You got to remember, I said, what you do affects us, you know, and we're just trying to set it up right. We want a level playing field, I said, and that's where we're going to get it. I said, and one thing, the other thing I can tell you is this, I said, our people have been here since the beginning of time. They'll be here long after you leave, and will continue to protect the water.
The EPA is taking public comments on the issue Wednesday in Lac des Flambeaux. For Independent Native News, I'm Nick Vanderpie.
Native American inmates at the Nevada State Prison say the Correction Department's recent wave of security measures has gone too far and trampled on sacred ground. The inmates wrote to Arlen Melendez, chairman of the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, after the prison tore down and burned a 20-year-old sweat lodge, which inmates used for a Native American spiritual cleansing ceremony. Chairman Melendez says sweat lodge rituals have been part of Nevada prison life for 20 years, and there should be attention paid to the Native American belief in sacred ground.
Well, it affects a lot of the Native Americans, you know, at the Nevada State Prison as far as their religious right. And I think the problem is some of the drastic changes that are taking place within the system in the name of security.
The recent measures have limited or stopped other social activities related to hobbies and crafts, music and gardening that were condoned under the previous head of state corrections, Jackie Crawford. New director Glenn Wharton has said the moves were made to comply with prison rules. Melendez and the Bureau of Indian Affairs are appealing to corrections officials to reconsider the move.
According to the traditional people that we've been in contact with, they buried eagle feathers, you know, where the sweat lodge has been for a number of years, so they kind of consider it sacred ground. The bottom line is, in the decision-making process by prison officials, you have to take that into consideration.
The Department of Corrections is now considering which activities and programs they will allow at the Nevada State Prison. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
KBOO Radio will have its first Ethnic Community Programmers Culture Diversity Day, Saturday, February 18th, from noon to 9 p.m. The purpose of this event will be for programmers to join in a day of celebration with each other and the community through music, history, and community pride. We'll be featuring programmers from the Latino, Asian, Native Indian, African American, and the Iranian community. You are also invited to our open house, cultural food sharing, from 1 to 6 p.m. Meet the KABU staff to discuss ways we can better serve our community and community radio station, KBOO Radio. That's Saturday, February the 18th from noon to 9 p.m. 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, KBOO, Cultural Diversity Day.